This is Paul. The Helen Lewis, who was famous in this little corner for that incredible, turned into a debate with Jordan Peterson a few years ago. It's even been watched more times than the Kathy Newman interview. I had a podcast, I think, for BBC. I don't exactly know how the BBC works. BBC Four, maybe that's what the four means down there. Had a podcast called The New Gurus that you can find, and she has episodes about different people, and I listened to it. But the one thing that stands out from that whole podcast was a term that she had picked up from someone else called internet poisoning. And most of what makes it into my videos are stuff with sticks in me, and that phrase sticks in me because There are times when I watch enough YouTube or I see enough Twitter, or I'm no longer on Facebook. I've never been on Instagram. You just have to turn the thing off because I feel it colonizing me. I feel levels of tension and distress, and I feel it distorting relationships and distorting perception. And maybe it's always distorting perception, but I only feel it when it gets to a certain state. And I think about that term a lot. You know, of course, we're always talking to people, and many of us are online a lot. We're online for work, we're online for play, we're online for community, et cetera, et cetera. And so that term internet poisoning just really stuck with me, and I continue to think about it, and especially now that the war has broken out in the Middle East. Joe Rogan, I'd love to play it for you. It's on YouTube, just the clip. I tried uploading a portion of it and it got blocked right away, so I'm not going to include it in this video, but Joe Rogan is just sort of freaking out about what's going on. And yeah, I understand that. I think part of that is internet poisoning. Part of what I think about is in terms of how Jonathan Peugeot did a terrific conversation with, I can't remember his name. He's a Kierkegaard. He just wrote a book on Kierkegaard. He talked with Peugeot and Verveke about Kierkegaard. He was talking about Plato. It was a great conversation that Jonathan did with him. But you know, part of what I reflect on in the whole progressive versus conservative battles are the ways in which technology has changed us, disrupted us, and empowered us. And I thought John's conversation with that was absolutely tremendous. And that's part of this freaking out. And so Joe, I'll play a little offline so I can repeat what he says. He says he's been freaking out over the last few weeks, mostly at nighttime. Like what would happen if we're like legit Armageddon, Mad Max, nuclear war. I should get my puppet out because I'm parroting him. Always got to resort to the puppet because, of course, it all gets blocked from Joe Rogan.
Like how far are we...
No. YouTube, don't strike me. It just gives me anxiety. Before I go to sleep, I'm just laying there. How does this all resolve? And then this effing Israel thing pops up. Like legit freaked out. And this guy, Brian Redband, says, I've definitely been buying a lot of prepper stuff for my house. They're getting solar and battery packs. And it's like, you know, the thing about the preppers is, This isn't like a hurricane or a big storm where you're out for maybe a few days or a couple of weeks. You know, did we learn nothing, Joe? Did we learn nothing during the global pandemic? How, you know, we live in a globally integrated world. You know what that means? Yeah, Joe says that's a good move. You can get like solar, that'll really help. And it's like, you're going to farm? Joe's concerned about the communication. How hard would it be to blow satellites up? And so then we don't know.
Yeah, that's why...
Then they're talking about getting on Starlink, so then they have great internet. And it's, again, it's like... And the funny thing for me is... Disaster happens to people all the time. As a pastor, you know they get cancer. There's a car accident. Something happens. There's a reason apocalyptic is a genre that doesn't go away. And then Joe makes a really good point. He says, you know, remember the day before 9/11? You don't know it's going to go bad until it goes bad. And of course, the Bible talks about that. They were, you know, before the days of Noah, they were eating and drinking, and bang, here comes the flood. This is the nature of our life in this world. Our life in this world is uncertain. You can't nail it down. You cannot establish for yourself your existence. That's part of what it means to be human. You got that, Joe? No, I don't think he's got it. He says, remember the day before 9/11? It was just normal America. Yay, yay. Anything can happen. If anything does happen, how much is the world going to change? Oh, I found my hands. I get my hands in there. How much is the world going to change? Remember the pandemic? Remember 9/11? The craziest thing about America is that life has been so good, and we should praise God for that goodness. Life has been so good. Life has been so stable that we have communicated to ourselves that we are gods on earth and we can secure for ourselves what we want. And, you know, you've heard it said many times in different situations. We do live in a network of relationships. And so we're sort of used to seeing others in a set of crisis. But when, you know, you see these beautifully tailored communities in the modern state of Israel, that is, I've never been there. I don't know if the event with myself and Peugeot and Verveke will ever happen in Israel. We'll see. But suddenly I think at a deep level, there's a sense for a lot of people in the United States, like, wow, nobody ever said it, but you have that when there's a hurricane or a tornado. Though, of course, always, you know, they show the trailer park that the tornado went through and all the Americans who live in a better home. Well, that wouldn't happen in my home. It does. The age of decay takes us all. Then he talks about super volcanoes or Mongols. The thing that I immediately thought of when I saw the news about Hamas and what they did, I thought of the Vikings. You know, Europe, places in Europe lived in absolute terror of the Vikings. Another one I'm about to say in any way excuses it, but this is life among humans on planet Earth. And the amazing thing for us is that we have a sense that this is not the way it's supposed to be. And that's an amazing thing that we have that sense. And I think that for me is one of the arguments for the existence of God. So Joe says, Nazi Germany, it can happen. Yes. And you know what? It will. Maybe not in your lifetime, maybe not in your neighborhood in your lifetime, but it will come to every neighborhood in someone's lifetime. This is the nature of life in this world. And he says, when I'm alone at night and a little high.
That's the thing that freaks me out.
So then he's thinking about international superpowers are willing to kill a certain number of people. And I don't think it's a number of people, because of course what Stalin said, you know, again, watch the movie Wag the Dog. It's not a number of people. Look at the millions of people killed in the Second World War. Usually for us, isn't that funny? The mixture of identities that there are in terms of when it hits home and when it doesn't. If somehow we identify, maybe we have a personal relationship, and of course the news has gotten expert at this stuff. When I watched this, I immediately thought, okay, we can put Joe away. I immediately thought of the Chris Williamson, Eric Weinstein conversation that opened with this.
You've been around a lot of very powerful, very rich people throughout your career.
No, that's not true. Only relatively recent, only in the last decade and a half.
That's quite a while in many people's lives.
Right.
What do you think that most normal people would be surprised to know about the powerful and the rich individuals' worldviews, the way that they hold themselves, what is and isn't true.
They feel powerless. That's one of the craziest things is that.
See, Joe Rogan feels powerless. He stays awake at night. He might be a little high. He feels powerless. And he and his friends who have all sorts of money and power, they're prepping. And again, there's a lot of biblical material about this, including, you know, the story of the barn builder. Jesus tells this parable about a barn builder, and the barn builder receives a windfall and suddenly has all of this grain, and the servants come and say, our barns are full, and build bigger barns. And then the barn builder says, I'll live out the rest of my life in peace and security. And God says, today I'm taking your life. How about that? And your money will go to people who, you know how inheritance money goes, whoosh, and it's gone.
Very often you're at a table of people of immeasurable wealth, and they're talking about the rich or the hyper-connected. They don't see themselves in these terms.
Why?
I think there's different kinds of rich, to be honest. I think that if, for example, you got rich from, let's say, arms manufacturing, you've been entwined with government your whole life, or if agriculture, something that's highly regulated, that's extraction, oil and gas. Those people, I think, have always been close to power. A lot of the dream of tech, for example, was we don't need the government. We'll just build stuff in our garages, and if it's cool, it'll take care of itself. And therefore,
we'll get a Tesla roof, and then we can just keep playing. Really? Do you really think the world works that way?
We're minimally dependent on the traditional ecosystems. So a lot of tech money felt disenfranchised. It didn't know how to play the game. And that was both to its credit and a huge danger. But I think one of the things that I find very interesting is that when people are not rate limited by money, they're rate limited by all sorts of other things. Like they may not want their number to go down. So to go from 6 billion to 4 billion would be a huge blow, even though it doesn't seem to impact normal things.
They'd stay awake at night, you know, I've lost $2 billion. I've only got 4 left. What am I going to do?
Another thing is that most of them have given up on the retail notion of reality.
What's that?
Whatever mainstream media, you know, if you have a worldview that allows you to listen to National Public Radio, then reads the Wall Street Journal and the Times and the New Yorker, whatever that point of view is, most of the very powerful rich people I know have checked out at a level that is astounding. They don't believe that they can afford to depend on normal institutions.
How does that show up in their lives?
Weird ways. You know, they don't have a regular doctor. They have concierge medicine. Their fire policy comes with a private fire department that will fight for their home, but won't necessarily fight for homes next door. Unless
I didn't know that that was a thing. Okay. Yeah.
It's not until you travel with some of these people that you realize that there's a secret corridor in the airport or a way of getting onto the plane. There's a lot of infrastructure built for a very small number of people. And, for the most part, they can't figure out what to do with the money. And it's my belief is that if you believe that the world is headed towards an apocalypse, you're very unlikely to want to contribute money because that's the only fungible thing you have in an emergency. And so I think that a lot of the sort of apocalyptic thinking of very powerful people is very destructive because they're trying to figure out how to survive a mild apocalypse, like a 6 months of your, you know, if I have 6 months of canned goods.
Those Tesla solar panels and your canned goods.
And I've got 4 ex-Navy SEALs on my property in a remote location of Montana. Can I weather the storm with a few diesel generators? So if it's a very mild apocalypse, maybe they've got 6 months plan. But a lot of, I think that there's a lot of thinking that you should husband your resources because you don't know what's coming, given that things are going to have to collapse. And I think it's very sad because those are the people who could shore up the system.
It's in.
It's just fascinating. And I think part of the internet poisoning is that Rogan says it in his piece, you know, I don't know what to believe. And it's true because just turn on YouTube and you hear it's coming at me. And it's, you know, it's Scott Adams, two screens on one screen. Oh, you know, they're hollowing out Gaza. On the other screen, it's just unspeakable. And again, I think. And again, what I'm about to say just in no way excuse or condone, because I want to condemn in the strongest possible terms what these people have done. You know, when you read in the Bible that Haman, the great general of Syria, has a Hebrew slave girl, how do you think he got her? If you read Blood and Thunder, is it Blood and Thunder? It's about the conquest of the Navajo by Hampton Sides. I think that's the guy's name. It was a great book. Great book. You know, this is the Navajo, and you know, you look at the slaving and the raiding that. Although of course this raid. This raid isn't for, it's not even for wealth. This raid is just pure politics. And you think this is for the Gaza Strip. This is like death by cop, you know, suicide by cop. Rod Dreher retweeted this piece by a guy named Philip Blonde. I don't know who he is, but I read it and I found it helpful for me because, truth be told, I'm just drowning in ignorance about this thing. Strategically, what does Hamas hope to achieve? Asking this question is inseparable from asking what does Iran hope to achieve. They both abhor a two-state solution. Neither wants peace in Israel in any form, and both want hegemony. Hamas over the Palestinian people, Iran regionally. The ideation that governs both is key and paramount. Belief is not a secondary factor, it is a prime motivator, and the elimination of Israel as an entity and a functioning state is the goal. There isn't a middle ground here. Ideologically, the destruction of Israel is the aim. In this, the sectarian differences between both can be subsumed. Any further conflict around Sunni-Shia lines, which will surely reemerge as it did over Assad and Syria, can now be resolved by the prime aim, the erasure of Israel. So what do I want? What do both want? I suspect they both want a long war to draw all actors into the final solution. That was, again, a piece, and I'll just pull up the video.
Back. I said top-down solutions. The word solution, I almost want to excise it from the political vocabulary because politics is a living, ongoing thing. It's a constant renegotiation. It's a constant putting new and fresh energy in to the system. Like you got to paint your house. You know, you got to take care of things.
Yeah, it's a living organism, really. Yeah.
Right.
And it has a kind of opponent processing
right
aspect to it, where it's like, right, you push a little harder this way, like,
right,
order and chaos.
So who talks about solutions? Well, it's a technical notion, yeah, right? Yeah. It's almost like a mathematical thing. And I kind of repeat this phrase. It seems to me that all political solutions, like real solutions, are final solutions, right? That is to say, it's death in some way. Incidentally, Jonathan, I've been thinking about the 34th canto of the Inferno, where, which actually begins with the line, it's quoted in Latin, you know, the banners of the king of hell advance, right? So it kind of identifies Satan as the king. And we have this image of Satan, and remember that he's like stuck in the ice. It's all frozen. It's all, you know, none of the condemned can speak to Dante. They're frozen in these things, right? And then you have Satan. And one of the translators has calculated that he's sticking up 1,000 feet from the ice, like Tower of Babel or something like this, right? And in his mouth are, you know, Judas and Cassius and Brutus. And as this same translator, John Sinclair, mentions, these are the guys who served Satan best, you know. They're the guys who serve. But the revolution needs its own in a way, right? I mean, this rebellious angel falls down and crashes into the earth. So I don't know. It's just it's a very rich image.
But it's rich in relation to what we're saying, which is,
and you know, when he says there in politics there is no solution but the final solution, which is of course. Jacob was talking to some other guys in the corner, and you know, Jacob was talking about, you know, moving all the people out of Gaza and putting them on these islands that are in the Persian Gulf. And it just reminded me at the beginning of the 20th century, they wanted to move all the Jews out of Europe, and Madagascar was one of the early contenders. Poland was looking seriously at moving all the Jews out of Poland to Madagascar. And of course, life in this world. So what do both want? I suspect they both want a long war to draw all actors into the final solution to the Jewish problem. Hamas wants Israel to come into Gaza, where it will be by no means clear that Israel will win. Indeed, Hamas will fight the IDF to a standstill. Neither Iran nor Hamas care about the Palestinian civilian population in Gaza. Indeed, they are a crucial part of the strategy, projecting victimhood daily on TV screens across the world. They want Israel to bomb and kill women and children as it serves their ends and is their means. A long war in Gaza very quickly becomes globally unpopular, but more important, its function as a means to ignite a broader front against Israel, both on its borders and the West Bank and its domestic Arab population. Iran has been moving to displace Fatah in the West Bank for a long time. Fighting in the Ain el-Hiway refugee camp in Lebanon has seen Fatah officials assassinated by Hezbollah and Iranian-backed elements. Iranian weapons and IED technology are being transferred to the West Bank. In short, the armed Iranian proxies are already in place in the West Bank, fomenting the coming uprising, helpfully accelerated by the coming war in Gaza. It would be foolish to assume that something similar is not taking place domestically in Israel. Again, I don't know. And feel free to comment and debunk and whatever. I'm open to reading it. Iran has created the conditions for advanced multi-front conflict in Israel, and the IDF entering Gaza is the ignition point for such. They judge that the time is right. Citing both Afghanistan and Ukraine, they believe that the U.S. no longer has the will to intervene decisively. You know, that whole no longer has the will argument was sort of what Putin had, and it hasn't served him. Highly ideological societies tend to tell you exactly what they will do and why. Recall Putin's long historical essays on Ukraine. In August 2022, interview posted on the Supreme Leader Ali Khomeini's website, the head of the IRGC, Hossein Salami, spoke quite explicitly. He wrote, "The outcome of the battle will determine when the struggle is on the ground, and the brave and experienced people of Hezbollah and Palestine will move on the ground in a single military formation. The conditions for this single movement are in place. They only require Israel to enter Gaza and for civilians there to be the public sacrifice for the ignition to take place. The other brutality of the Hamas incursion was designed to force Israel to attack Gaza. This is the ultimate strategy at play. It serves the interest of Hamas, who will hope to rule any Palestinian state that emerges from the conflagration, to serve Iran, who will then attain its arc of influence and regional hegemony, but most importantly, it will eliminate Israel. it can't quite make sense of what is happening outside this. I can't quite make sense of what's happening outside of this scenario. It's a strategy to wipe Israel off the map, which makes all of this talk of peace and place at the table and mediated gains utterly superfluous. I feel the moves are as big as this. So what should Israel do? Generally, it's not wise to do what your enemies want, so entering Gaza is an extremely risky endeavor. But Hamas must be defeated and removed from power. But how do you do this without a ground war? Western strategists need to ask what could change the calculations here. The fulcrum point is indeed Iran, and perhaps there's the only player that could draw the calculus is the United States. But what would entail threatening and possibly delivering a direct confrontation? Israel itself, with its existence under threat, could take the fight to Assad or other Iranian proxies, but Hezbollah is already primed to invade from the north, and the West Bank similarly so. Yeah, chilling, chilling. And I ponder all, I watch all of the multi-layered principalities at work, these groups in America and Europe that somehow get a sense of solidarity with the Palestinians and saying, you know, horrendous things about killing and celebrating attacks like this. And you have all these multi-layered identities, and those identities start crossing in all different directions. But then, you know, this would have been different 5 years ago when I knew some Jews back from New Jersey when I was a kid and working in a lumber yard. And I remember Leon Chase was an old carpenter, an old Jewish carpenter, had come into the lumber yard, and he had been in a Nazi camp, and he still had the tattoo of his number right on his arm. I remember seeing that as a young adult and a college student working there at the lumber yard, and just thinking, wow. And he'd tell stories about, you know, working in those camps. I'm sure he's passed by now. You know, it's hard to believe that's 30 years ago for me, going on 40 years. But, you know, people I've met, people I know, ancestry, you know, there's this weird thing that, you know, 8 years ago, no, longer than that now, 12 years ago, you know, oh, my father's side, they were Jews leaving the Netherlands, switched religions. But others have those family connections. Others have those personal connections. You know, many Christians have taken tours of Israel and come back and said, yeah, you know, it's really not great to be not in power there. So much ignorance. I watched some Al Jazeera today. They had some Start Here videos, which I'm sure are propaganda as much as anything. And just one about the Al-Aqsa Mosque and, you know, talking about, you know, it's a detonator, and just realizing, yeah, you know, what an American in secularism makes. You listen to the new atheist. Well, you know, religion's going away. And it's like, I don't think it's going away. It's taken very seriously. And in fact, it seems that Jerusalem is drawing to itself people that take her more and more seriously all the time. And so I couldn't, as I watched this, I'm not going to play the Al Jazeera thing because I don't want to have to deal with YouTube blocking and all that stuff too. But the end of that one piece on, I'll put the links below. I mean, part of the reason that you want to be part of a religious tradition is that, in fact, you can, you know, around here they said, well, he has an old soul. You want to have an old soul? Invest in an old religion. Your soul will get older because you'll be tied into a people and a community that goes back thousands of years. But beware, it will unsettle your world. And I think of, you know, Hezi and Ahama and, you know, praying for their safety, hoping they're okay, because of course once you develop a personal relationship, you know, I've so enjoyed my conversations with Hezi and Nechama, and, you know, really grown to appreciate who they are. And yeah, I pray for peace, but I fear that very large forces have found sort of a, I mean, it seemed, again, full of ignorance, so, you know, Israel practiced a containment strategy for Gaza, and obviously that containment strategy was destroyed, so now what? Now what? But I also know, because crisis of the day, and here in beautiful, wonderful California, the attentional eye of Sauron turns, because Ukraine, COVID, woke wars, just zip, 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 zip. The ADHD media attention. Look over here, look over there, look over there, look over there. Attention, 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 attention. We're feeding it attention.
The internet has afforded a space where the relationship between attention and power has been increased, you know, by thousands of times. And so all of a sudden, people understanding that how attention can be a weapon, right? And attention can be a way to dominate and can be a way to seduce. And you have 100,000 people, you know, 100,000 people under you that can act as your body. That how attention can be a weapon, right? And attention can be a way to dominate and can be a way to seduce. Now you have 100,000 people, you know, 100,000 people under you that can act as your body.
What you're talking about.
Yeah, and the internet is like a monster. The internet is a being that lives through attention. The internet is like a monster. The internet requires our attention to exist. Like the internet is like a monster. The internet is a being.
Put it away, Bones. How many times?
This is from Friday Norm Morning Nameless, Prosperity Gospel on the Enterprise. Soon we'll lose interest if it doesn't expand. The funny thing about that I often tell my kids, I say, you know, in 1939, people didn't know they were in World War II. They didn't know that in 1936, but the Japanese were already in China, and Hitler was already gobbling up Europe. And it's not until you're in it neck deep that you know you're in it. So we could already be in it, and yeah, we wouldn't. We don't know it yet. We don't know it. Noticed on, you know, the Al Jazeera piece. What does real peace actually look like for everyone? Well, now we're at the religious level, and Grimm was working on yesterday's video, and what he said just really struck me. When I made the video before, I mean, there's a ton of existentialism in here, and Cooper's going to talk about that, because that's where this goes in the 20th century. It goes into existentialism, because, okay, if we've sort of thrown out the mythological symbolic language, and we no longer take that seriously, and the history of the physical Jesus doesn't really matter that much. Just his words, just the impact of the kerygma, of the preaching, of the proclamation of.
Now, kerygma is one hell of a word.
When you read Karl Barth, you just have this sense of moments of transformation that come upon you at the, you know, it's very existential.
That line right there, honestly, ladies and gentlemen, is where the text from the thumbnail comes from. What does it take to...
Now he had AI make for him lungs of clay. And I was a little disturbed that the title of the video was not lungs of K-L-A-Y, Grizz. It was such an obvious wordplay that you're a wordplay genius, Grizz. You missed that one.
The move, I mean.
That preaching of the proclamation of the... I mean, when you read Karl Barth, you just have this sense of moments of transformation that come upon you at the, you know, it's very...
And let's think about those for a moment. Like, I sit here in this pretty disastrous routine of my life, right? And I think, what would it take? What sort of external event or change shift in context would it take to move me out of the routine I'm in and into a new form of behavior? And
what's amazing is that, of course, is global. It's the principalities. What would move the principalities out of this road that they're on that leads to destruction, and nobody can seem to find the way out? Again, the fact that we got out of the 20th century without a nuclear exchange between the United States and the Soviet Union. People say, I don't believe in a miracle. It's pretty darn close, boys and girls. It's pretty darn close. And so what would bring you peace? But it's also the same for an individual, because we're always living in these two poles. We're always stuck there in the middle.
And things immediately next. Would it take to move me out of the routine I'm in and into a new form of behavior? And things immediately come to mind, like a new life, like my morality attaches its responsibility to, like, to maintain the integrity of my character, certain, like, you know, like a cat. When a new cat shows up meowing outside, that changes my life, because in order to maintain my not even my logoic, right, but my the integrity of my sense of self, certain contexts and situations would demand a response and a shift, and those things.
And that's just such a, I mean, Grizz seeing the tension there, because a transformation is not a substitution. A transformation is a rebirth. And again, all of the language, you know, I put the, of course, I'm quoting Jesus, that which would bring you peace, Jesus lamenting over Jerusalem. As he's coming down in the triumphal entry, he'll be hailed as king, and then he will be crucified as a slave and a criminal. This is how this world is.
Those things are my first guesses as what it takes to move a man. We're going to go back into that at the end of the stream, I think. But meanwhile, think on it, and what it would take for you to change your routine and direct your life in a different way. What values do you hold so dear that they're more important than your ability to have agentic effect in the world, that like in service of this value, I would sacrifice it all? What are those? What does it take to move you?
We all know that there is no agency any living gent can see. Doing what is right for me is lifting up my bro so he can grow some eyes to see that doing what is right for me increases all our aging.
There's a little Grim Grizz branding for you if you've never been to the channel, but, you know, of course, my job is transformation with people, to foster, facilitate, midwife, prompt, promote, support, encourage. And of course, I too have a theological system, and my theological system says that I am not the master of that in others. If God, only God actually does that. And God can certainly use me and use others. And so I make myself willing and available. But the thing that I was thinking about when I was watching Grizz talk about this was how we're even unsure of what this looks like. We're even unsure of what this looks like. And then in the Al Jazeera piece, and they had some older woman, and she's just kind of talking political babble with all of the little buzzwords about peace and blah, 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 blah. And again, one of the things that struck me that Jordan Peterson said repeatedly, it's when he'd work with his clients, when they would start speaking in the theological register, you'd know that, okay, now we're getting down to the layer of where this stuff goes. The political is downstream. It is the transformation of ourselves and of our principalities. So now when I watched the Ben Shapiro piece, I never watched Ben Shapiro. Rick sent me an email and said, sent me a message, said, you know, I just watched that Ben Shapiro piece. And yeah, it's a rough piece. And I thought of Jacob immediately when the piece started, because he said, anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism. And I know how Jacob feels about Zionism. But he and Trey and Charlie were talking on the chatting stream. And
idea of what was going on. What he was talking about was absolutely correct, which is that the Palestinians operate under a very different moral code than the Israelis and Americans do.
Now, which Palestinians? Because part of what you have is, again, modernity, secularism, was in very many ways sort of this stealth Christianizing force in the world that brought a fair amount of peace, because it sort of, you take the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights and you scratch it a little bit and you see mid-century mainline Protestantism, and those standards went around the world and were colonized around the world by the United Nations, and debate all kinds of things about the United Nations and that, but that's what was under them. And what Jacob starts arguing here is that, again, this gets back into the labels things, Palestinians, yada, 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 but the people who did such things against Israel are working under a different set of values. And Grizz talks, you know, humans are amazing because human beings can have work on so many different value systems and do such starkly different things.
Which is absolutely true. And that was his point. Trey,
right.
Did you see the videos of Shani Luke being... her dead, naked body being paraded through the streets as people yelled Allahu Akbar? Did you see that video?
No, I did not.
Are you surprised that something like that happened? I can show you the video. It happened.
No, I know, but I can't make a response. Yes, that is terrible.
No, I didn't ask you if it's terrible. I asked you, are you surprised?
No, I'm not surprised.
Why are you not surprised? Because Muslims do that. Would you be surprised if something like that happened in Tel Aviv? Yes, you would.
Okay. Well, you know what? I'd be more surprised if this happened in Dubai.
If that's probably because you don't know Muslim culture well enough.
I think there's a different level analysis, and I don't think it's as straight as this. Again, like, the more economic usually a country becomes, the more Western they become.
Okay, I realize you have Marxism installed at the deep most.
Okay, it's it's sort of buying into the world system. But again, you can of course take this and go different ways, and you can say, you know, you can debate Islam and on and on and on and on and on. My point isn't that. My point is to point to the value thing, that we participate in systems, and these values and these transformations that that Grizz is talking about, these are deep. And then what value system would you give your life to? What's the value system would be worth a life? Now, obviously, the men who drove the planes into the trade centers on 9/11 had a value system that they gave their life to, and they felt it was worth their lives. But each of us has value systems, and then we have to ask ourselves, what are those value systems? What is good? Very basic questions about what is good, what is true. And going back to the Theo Von, John Vervaeke, I'm not going to play that because my whole video gets demonetized if I play that, but which I don't really care that much. I only monetize about half my videos anyway, but what would you die for? What would be worth a life? And what's interesting is that those things are above us. That those things that we say, okay, I have my little, even Americans, if I should probably, play the video that I played, that I preached about selling Sunset. Because Americans have sort of this altruistic hedonism that we like to promote. And we have this idea that happiness is most important, and we, what's most important in life is happiness, and sort of the atheism sort of instills that in us, that what all that really matters is sort of right here. But then when events like this happen, we are drawn to deeper conversations about values and what is worth dying for, and if it's worth dying for, then what is worth living for? Because actually, living for something is harder than dying for something, because death comes in an instant, but life is a series of choices again and again and again and again. Luke's been just chatting on Grail Country in the mornings, and the timing works for me because I can usually sort of hop on and hop in and see my friends and play with my friends a little bit on the internet. And meet Max, got a chance to meet Max for the first time. He's an Orthodox missionary in Sierra Leone and works for John Beer's organization. John was on the channel not too long ago. But Sam said some interesting things about Islam and you know, sort of the debate that's been going on in America and on screen. But for me this just always ends in prayer, because we find ourselves out of our depth. Part of what all of the debate on the internet presumes is that we can sort of be God over all the world and judge. Now, we always have to make judgments. And life forces judgments upon us. That's actually a theme in this video, in this stream. But in many ways, you know, it just ends in prayer for me, because do I want the killing to stop? Yes. Do I want peaceful, good lives for Israelis and Palestinians? Yes. How can the world get there? I don't know. Do I even know what that looks like? Probably not. Do I have images and pictures? Yeah. But then again, I look at the most beautiful. I used to, people would talk about, you know, impoverished communities or marginalized communities or all of this. I said, well, show me the ideal community. And usually they think in economic terms. And so here in Sacramento, we might think of El Dorado Hills or Folsom or Granite Bay or, you know, a wealthy suburb outside of Sacramento where you're up on the hills looking over town and, you know, million-dollar houses. No. $1 million is table stakes for houses right now, my friends, in Sacramento, for if you want a really nice house. And I say, yeah, but I know those people and they're subject to all of this stuff.
Many of you have seen this show on Netflix. It's called Selling Sunset. And this is most of the cast of the show. It's built around a real estate group in Los Angeles that are selling probably the most high-priced real estate you can find, even in a state like California. But the cast almost looks like something from a Bond film, complete with sort of these two short, bald guys who run the organization. And these are sort of surgically modified spectacle women competing for men, money, fame, attention, and everything else. It's sort of like the brightness is turned up too high on the television when you watch it. If you think about what strawberry candy is like, you try to take the strawberry flavor from the candy and you add lots and lots of sugar, and then if you try to eat it and you compare that with the taste of a real strawberry, well, they're kind of like the candy. It's just cloying. You watch a few minutes of it and it's don't quite know how you should feel. Now, what's really interesting that in a lot of ways, they sort of exemplify what I think for many in America is kind of a default American religion. It's sort of an altruistic hedonism. What's most important is your current emotional state and that it be the best current emotional state possible all the time. To be happy is to have to be the recipient of the best possible situation, to have all of the money, to have all of the beauty, to have all of the pleasure, to have all of the attention, and you hope to go from one euphoric state to the next. Again, it would be like eating a diet of only candy, all the time. And so people try to string these things out in as seamless a line as possible, all the way up till death. Now, what's interesting, however, is that, so that's sort of the idea that happiness in me is a function of all good things around me, all beautiful things around me, all pleasant things around me. So if I can surround myself with good things, then my insides will feel good. It's basically an idea that my insides are simply the product of the sum total of the good things around me. Sort of a good arena makes for a good agent. Now, what's amazing about the show, however, that for all of the glitz and all of the beauty, now by season 6, there's very little attention actually paid to these outstandingly beautiful multi-million dollar properties that are in the hills around Los Angeles looking in on the kingdom. All of the show is really about are all of these women fighting with each other. It's just drama all the time, which lends questions to their idea about how the good life can be had. Because they're all beautiful, they're all tall, they're all wealthy, they spend thousands and thousands of themselves doing all of this, and they all seem absolutely miserable. And the only joy they have is in cutting each other down. I don't think that's a good life, but there they are. And in some ways, the nation sort of looks at them and says, these people have arrived. And to me, I look at them and say, they've arrived anywhere. It kind of looks like a really shiny, beautiful hell. The show has a spirit, and the spirit is vicious. And that vicious spirit of reputation savaging is why people watch it and enjoy it. Now, part of the difficulty about using that word spirit is that in modernity, it's sort of a difficult word.
Part of what I think is that the transformation we're looking for doesn't fully arrive in this world. This world isn't quite big enough for even one human being to arrive in it. And Christians believe that when the one human being who had it, we killed him. We couldn't stand the sight of it. So I just pray. I get to a point like this and I pray. I pray for peace. I pray for justice. I pray for I pray. That's where I'll end it. Leave a comment.